Well, this is kind of a, I don't want to call it a beginner lesson. It's a basic lesson. I want to do a basic series, and I don't know exactly where it's going to go. I have an idea where we're going to go. It's kind of like going to California, but I'm not sure exactly what route we're going to use to get there. But it has to do with the Bible, and of course, for us, that's a very precious thing. And I want to know, I want to establish in our mind, starting with today, is exactly what the Bible is. Because if that's not clear in our mind, then what the Bible does for us down the road will be different than it should be. So we're going to answer that question to begin with, and it will not be answered completely today. So we did, like Vince Lombardi said, gentlemen, this is a football, and there's a story about that. Going back to the basics, and we're not going to go back to the basic, but we are going to go back to below the basics. You know, our assumptions about the Bible are sometimes flawed. So I've thought about this statement many times when thinking about teaching the Bible. The basis of it are assumed and sometimes can be misleading. Our assumptions can be misleading, and I think we do immediately come upon a watershed in our thinking about the Bible. You know, there's those that think this way, and the other half thinks this way, the watershed issue. So how we think about the Bible is that. So what is the nature of the Bible? So we begin our studies this morning, ladies and gentlemen. I could hold my Bible up and say, this is the Bible. Now, in the process, we'll talk a little bit about our heritage. I think it's very important that we understand that we have a heritage that we want to preserve, and it has to do with how we look at the Bible, how we understand the Bible. And I've told you this before. These are things that I, in my advancing age, would say things I wish I had to ask my grandpa. Now, there aren't many things I wish I'd asked my grandpa because they weren't particularly into theology, and I wasn't particularly old enough to think about it. But in retrospect, I would have liked to ask him a few questions. But I was doing something else, maybe distracted. And then on the other hand, this is me now, things that grandpa wants to tell his grandchildren, well, they're just too busy with doing something else. You have this. You got this thing. I've often wondered about this. Is this the way it should be? You know, just as an example, I don't know if I have had any of my grandchildren in any of my classes I've ever taught. Well, I think I can say that because I don't know who it would be. So that's terrible. You know, shouldn't they be in your class? After all, this grandpa is teaching. They've been out doing something else. So somebody else is teaching them. So I get this idea if they'd only would ask grandpa, they'd be a little better off. Now, I know that's a little bit hubris there, but I still have that, and you still have it in your mind. You want our kids to be like us. So this heritage thing is a wonderful thing. We want to pass on to our children what has been, in some cases, painstakingly discovered. We have recipes. I thought about some of you guys that are, you know, about Tweebuck, you know, about the old German bakeries, and then we have time management, how we do with our time. When I was young, I went to bed late, got up late. Now I'm old, and I go to bed early and get up early. Earning wealth, what do you do with your money? You go and borrow a lot of money to buy a new car. What do you do to keep healthy? Those kind of things. You know, do you eat cheeseburgers, which I love? I don't like cheeseburgers, but anyway, people do. So we have all these things. We say we need to tell our children these things so they don't make the same mistakes we've made. Or we've learned some things that they should learn from. So we want our next generation to benefit from the last, so that what may be gained by us may not be lost. And then we have this wishful thinking. So heritage is important. In all reality, it really comes down to the contribution that parents make to the children is their existence. That's about it. Their existence. Without you, they wouldn't be. So you are a very vital, important key in that existence. So from there on, it seems like every generation must begin again the task of making sense of their own existence. And once in a while, a grandpa can throw an idea into it, and they might ask a grandpa, or they might whatever learn, but something, when it really gets down to it, I've noticed this, that the kids, they are on their own. So especially grandchildren. Now I've got great-grandchildren. I got a picture of them all last week, all sitting together. So, well, Christians, more than any other person, should have a keen awareness of history. People say, I don't like history. Yes, you do. You're making it, so come on. You got to have a keen awareness of history, since the gospel is rooted in the events of history. We do have a historical faith. It's not ahistorical. While the Bible is not a history book, the events are real history, and I might add, much of it is independently verifiable. Not all of it. So we have a historic Jesus who died for sinners, a sinner's death, was raised on the third day to secure our redemption from sin, all rooted in real history. Now, in this class, will not be hard to get that agreement that history is, that the history of our redemption is found in the Bible. In fact, there's widespread agreement across all Christian stripes that if you want to know about redemption, the place to go is the Bible. While it is true that we find that, while this is true, we find that not everyone agrees with the nature of that redemption and exactly what the Bible says or means about that subject. So are we saved from the penalty of sin, or are we saved from another sense of a tyranny that is unnamed, but all of its redemption? So many Christians give wide range of value to the Bible, or maybe I should say people, give wide range to the Bible. They wonder exactly what the Bible does say, what is it authorized to speak about. Maybe it's all a mystery, a puzzle for a few to solve, and then so it goes from useful to useless somewhere along that. So since these questions are out there, not in your minds, in the minds of your friends, that's where we're going to start, what the Bible is. So the question is not about who are the attributed authors of the Bible or when they wrote or even the subject that they covered. That's not where we're going to approach this. We'll touch on these things, but the question is more basic than that. So I say it's a basic fundamental issue is, what is the Bible after all? What is it? So we go on the man on the street, or the homeless man on the street in this case, says, if we did a man on the street interview, ask the question, what is the Bible? These are some answers you would probably give, and you might add yours to it. Well, it's a good book. It's a good history book. It tells us of Jesus. It's inspirational. It's comforting. It tells us how to live. It tells us how to be saved. It's God's word. It's about loving. Well, are there any of those things wrong? Not really. These and many other answers are not wrong necessarily, but in order to grasp the fullest value of the Bible, I believe the best way to understand the Bible is that it is a contract. Now, I heard somebody say to me, a contract? How can that be? Well, it is a contract. Want to do that again? A contract. So now, again, we think other ideas. So now the book is not a contract. It's an inspirational set of ideas that gives us inspiration. It's a book of good sayings. It's a devotional. We read a verse every day and apply every verse every day. Every verse in the book is mine. You know, every promise is given. No, not really. But anyway, it's a devotional book. It's John 3:16. Without that, we don't need anything else. That's a way to look at the Bible. It's a guide for living, how I should treat my neighbors and so on. I read it for ideas on how I can live a better life. So these ideas, I'm like we had before with the man on the street interview. It is likely that few will understand the Bible, that the Bible is by its very nature a contract written by God for the benefit of, I said man here, but he is a secondary benefactor of it. God is his own benefactor of his own contract, and we get to observe it. Now, I'm going to talk about basic fundamental ways you look at the scripture. Now, you say this really doesn't matter. It does. And we're going to show this down the road, how this makes a big difference where you start with how you understand the Bible, what it is. So it is a contract that God has written, not for us, not for the angels, not for the devil, but for himself. So how can this be, you know, I write a contract to myself? Well, I'm not God, so maybe it doesn't make any sense if I do it. But when God does it, it makes sense, which we'll try to demonstrate in these weeks. Have you ever heard of God, a God, any God who has entered into a contract with his subjects? Now, do you want how much time you need to think about that? I mean, just think about that, how big it is and how different Christianity is that it can claim that. That the God they serve, the creator God, has entered into a contract that we can read, which means that we have discovered him, which I'm going to get to my next slide here, but that he becomes knowable. So whoever heard of a God, small g, who had entered into a contract with his subjects? Are those people that have this kind of small g God, are they not the same kind? Are they not in some kind of guessing game, trying to find out what angers or pleases their God? Since he's not written, remember, if he is not written, he has not spoken. He is in hiding. And we have these poor people on earth trying to do what he wants them to do. It's got to be an enigma. So we have only in Judeo-Christian does God obligate himself in a contract. And where man comes in is he gets to read it. So we might say, well, Islam has writings. But look at the, and you don't have to know much about Islam's book, the Quran, but you know this or can understand this. Islam has writings, but they're not from God or from even from Allah. It's from the prophets. Now, I know they maybe make a comparison, and we get into why are they not as good as, quote, our prophets. Our prophets were good, and they were never wrong. All right? Islam has writings, but don't be confused here. Islam has writings, but where is the idea of a contract in these writings? What is puzzling in the Quran, all the subjects are afraid to act since God hasn't, their God hasn't said what? Since they've not said, any action is potentially offendable to Allah. So therefore, to be on the safe side, they do nothing, including cleaning their streets. It gets down to something that simple. Because anything they do might be offensive. See, their God, Allah, has not spoken. They haven't a clue what they should do. They haven't a clue. All they know is they have to submit whatever that means. That's what the word means. So it's only in Judeo-Christianity does God obligate himself in a contract. Well, there is no other religion where God speaks, much less puts his intentions into writing. Now, you say, where did God speak? Anybody can remember where that happened? Mount Sinai, right. Anyplace else? The garden? Where God speaks, what did he say? Oh, okay, in the Garden of Eden. Okay, sure. I was thinking Transfiguration. Okay, yep. And we have that in the, his baptism. So we said, well, that's a few times. Oh, but once you've established a speaking God, you have established his character. You know, we just have just one, oh, that guy, I don't know what happened there. No, we've had it a number of times where he's actually spoken. If you had had a tape recorder running, you could have recorded it. And you could play it back for a class this morning. All right? We have a real event. So there's no other religion where God speaks, much less now takes these speeches and puts them into writing. Putting the acts of God into writing will allow the subjects, that's us, to verify his character. I thought about this. You know, God didn't have to do this. I mean, put it in writing. He didn't have to speak to man. It probably, the same outcome would have been the same. If God wanted to do what he wanted to do, he didn't have to tell man what he's going to do. But the privilege we have, we found out what he's going to do because he told us what he's doing and in some cases what he's going to do. And when that happens, like he said it was going to happen, that verifies, validates who he is and what his character is like. So, all right. So God, what God does here is so that he can be known and be examined. The contract is so that he can be known and that he can be examined. Since gods, the small g gods, hide, who knows whether they exist at all? And we know well and good they don't exist. They've been created in the imagination of those that have created them. So again, I want to make sure that we understand how significant it is that we have a God who has spoken in real time and has written down his intentions. That's, well, maybe they're not really true. That's another different issue. But that's the way it presents itself, and we know that that's how it works out. So only Christianity does God obligate himself in a contract. Why did he do this, and where did he do this? Why did he do this? Well, simply to make himself known. I mean, the most basic reason is to make himself known, to make himself visible in our mind, and in some cases, visible for those people that heard him. Where did he do this? Well, the Bible is in its core nature a contract of terms that God has assumed for himself. These terms are not what God requires of man, although there are exceptions. We got to explain some of this stuff. But the thing that makes the Bible a unified whole is that it is a contract that obligates God. Well, when we encounter contracts, we tend to think of them as an agreement between two parties. We entered a contract to purchase a car, washing machine, pledging that we will pay so many dollars each month while the seller's party will advance the money to pay for the car or the washer, and you pay him back. Simply, you borrow the money and promise to pay it back at a certain rate of interest. This is the most common arrangement, a two-party contract, both sign it. Now, sometimes you don't actually do all of this stuff. Sometimes you just sign one contract, you can do this, but if you have a contract to sale, you have to have both people sign it. But yet sometimes you don't get into that kind of deal, but you would, let's say, if you're buying a house. Because the party that's going to sell has to sign a contract that he's going to sell it to you on the same basis you're going to buy it on, then you have to both sign the contract. So a two-party contract. So a two-party contract usually is assumed that is that if the Bible is a contract, then, by part two, two-party contract assumed here, that God promises to do his part and man promises to do his part. So we have two parts, God and man, they do agree and they have this contract. But is that what we have? But we find the Bible contract is different because it is a one-party contract. Well, have you ever heard of a one-party contract? You know, I'm going to buy a house with one party. Well, somebody has to agree to sell it. So we don't see it there. So one that obligates only one side. A little bit unusual, but not completely. Surprising, there are examples of a one-party contract. We call it a unilateral contract. Now, all wills, talking about last wills and testaments, all wills do not qualify as a one-party contract because some wills, maybe you guys have wills, have conditions in your wills. Some wills have a performance qualifier in them. For example, I don't have any sons, so I can use my example here. I will my entire fortune to my son unless he leaves the state of Nebraska before he's age 21. So as long as he stays within the confines of Nebraska, the provisions of the will stand. And he'll get what I have for him. So it means that if my son crossed the border before he's 21, the will is null and void, then the money goes to the state, whatever. So we call this a conditional will or a conditional contract. Will is a contract. Sometimes we call it my last will and testament. All right, what is our new and old? Really? Interesting. So we have the conditional or unconditional contract. Since certain things must or must not happen, else another provision kicks in. In our example, the loss of inheritance. But wills can be without strings attached and can be unlimited. We will not get into the best way for you to do this, and some of you have done this, and how you're going to do this sometimes becomes kind of a hard thing. You accumulate the wealth, and you know how to get rid of it, so because people will fight over it. The four things you have left over. But anyway, there's laws about this, and Jim Titus come talk about that if you want to. All right, so I remember about giving away stuff unilateral. I remember an old man lived over at one of the retirement centers, gave a new car to a young girl. She was 16 years old that took care of him. She really appreciated, he's a real old man, like his 90s. And she was like 16, and so he gives her this new car. What do you think? Well, the heirs protested, but there was little they could do about it. After all, the will was honored, and even if there are unhappy provisions. Now, honestly, the old man hadn't died yet when he did this, but the same principle applies. If he would have died, they couldn't have done anything about what he did. It's his money. Since his wife was gone, she couldn't claim half of it. All right, so we have one-party contracts. We have another very common one-party contract. That is a bank draft, personal check. Some of these, though, are implied two-party checks because I write a check to Hy-Vee, they give me groceries. So we have two people involved here, all right? So we got to exclude that kind of, that's a one-party contract, but there's an obligation implied. But excluding these kind of Hy-Vee checks or whatever, more like the checks you give at birthdays or Christmas, that's more what we're talking about, where you write a check for, let's say, $25 and make it an unattached gift. You say, here it is. You don't say, now I want you to buy some shoes with it. You couldn't even buy shoes for $25. You could buy a burger at McDonald's, all right. No, you can do whatever you want with it. Put it in savings. That'd be a good idea, Grandma. So for college saving, whatever. So it's unattached. They can do whatever they want with it. They give it to their friends. You say, fine, whatever. He needs it worse than you do. Fine, give it to him. So we have this one-party contract without strings attached. When the check is cast, it is not restricted in any way. Now, what would happen if I would make that check out and dated it, filled in the pay to the order of you, then signed it, but did not put in the amount? Stupid. Now, all conditions are removed and becomes an unconditional, unlimited contract. Oh, wait a minute. There's one more thing yet about this analogy. Looking further, there looks yet another condition implied in the draft. The condition is that the check cannot be for more money than in the account. So the bank will not honor an overdraft. Now we have squeezed every kind of possible condition out of the one-party contract. We now have the kind of contract represented in the Bible. God writes the check, leaves the blank amount blank, and there's no concern that he's going to be overdrawn. So he's got an infinite value in this check. He writes the check out. Now here's where it gets kind of fuzzy. Who does he write it out to? We're going to have to say he's going to have to write it out to himself to make this work. But nonetheless, the contract is going to be enforced even if he makes it out to himself. He obligates himself, see? As every analogy breaks down, the contract provides what God will do and pledges his word backed by his resources to accomplish. To accomplish his intention in restoring his creation. That's what he's actually doing. Is I'm promising to do this to restore that which was lost. And in this process, it will cost him what is dearest to him, his son. So in the analogy, who does God pay off? And this is a big argument over the years. Actually, the payment goes back to God. It does not go to the devil. It does not go to us. It doesn't go to anybody except it goes back to him. We're not going to get into that. We're just going to assume that because it's a whole new issue that people will spend a lot of time talking about. So now we are going to recognize two kinds of looks at the Bible. First of all, it is an unconditional, unilateral, one-party contract. And in that option, the creation is restored. And remember, I put creation first, which includes the restoration of fallen man. I don't want to reverse this. Okay, now we'd like to reverse because we think everything's about us. We're millennials after all. It's all about us. Very easily could slip into that as Christians because it's all about us. Now, if there is no unconditional unilateral contract, let's just say there's no contract. The Bible is just a devotional book. Did you get out of it what you want? And it makes your day happier if you read the right parts. If that's what you see in the Bible, then you'll find that the Bible is a book that talks about the restoring of fallen man. That's basically it. That's a redemption book. It's a book about redemption. And anything else doesn't count. So make no claims about the rest of creation. So there we have it. We have just crossed the watershed. Either God's going to restore his entire creation, or he's just going to restore man and throw the rest of creation away. Based on the contract. We say God's going to enforce his word, and those guys are saying there's no such thing. The contract is not unilateral. It is not conditional. It's flexible. You can make whatever you want out of it. And since we know the heart of man, the heart of God, he wants to save man, that's what everything is about. Okay. So we're talking about something very basic. So the Bible as an unilateral contract. Unilateral contract, what is promised, what is not? Well, the Bible has some kinds of conditions written in it. There are some. There are the if-then-else routines. They're explained outside the unilateral contract. Does not affect it. There are kinds of conditions, but they cannot change the unconditional unilateral basis of it, or else it destroys the unilateral unconditionality of it. You try to say that. So hold those questions about these if then for later. So now we have basically the way the Bible is broken down into sections. We have the preamble, chapters 1 through 11, and then we have the contract itself, only three verses. Three minor verses. I mean, minor like small, verses. And then we have from Genesis 12, verse 4, through the end of Revelation, we see the execution of the contract. And for us, it's not even done yet. So we're in the process of observing God make good his contract. It's not finished yet. So let's look at the preamble first. Well, every contract needs some kind of context in which to live and be enforced. There would need to be an iteration of places, people, things, events. Now, in a regular contract, a lot of these things are assumed. Sometimes they have to be written in there. You know, who the parties are, what property we're talking about, you know, all these kind of things, a little history, the grandchild of, so on. These histories have to be written into the contract, or it's have to put somewhere so we know who we're talking about. So I'm just put these like in a category called a preamble. Okay, so that would be a reiteration of places, people, things, and so forth that have brought about the need for a contract. You're not writing contracts if there's no need, you know, like an exercise. So then, in Genesis 1 through 11 chapters, we might have this and use this kind of language. Whereas God has exhausted the opportunities given man to make reconciliation with his creator, God unilaterally assumes his sovereign right to craft a peace for man, one on his own terms and at his own expense. That's one way to do it. Another way to do it. Whereas God's created the heavens and the earth, whereas God created man to subdue and fill the earth, whereas man disobeyed God's orders, whereas God cursed man to hard labor and the creation to hard groanings, Romans 8, therefore God can redeem man and bless them, whereas God intends to do that very thing. He can do it, and he wants to do it because it pleases him. So in order to accomplish this work, God will choose a man through whom the work of restoration will be implemented. That's a preamble. However you want it, you can maybe write your own, attach it to the beginning of the contract, because the contract doesn't sit out by itself. It has a context, and the context is Genesis 1 through 11. Genesis 1 through 11 is not part of the contract. It's part of the preamble. So in that sense, it is part of the contract, like you would have in any preamble. So we have now simply, the Bible is a contract. And the way I like to think about it, the Bible is a contract. Now think of the Bible, if you hold it up, you hold it on the edge. The binding of this Bible holds together the place and the order of each page. You go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And if they're not in that order, it's going to be kind of confusing, right? Sometimes I print out documents that don't have page numbers in them, and they get mixed up. Now, you got to look at this sentence. Does this continue on the next page? So make sure you keep in the right order. So the order of these pages, or the order of things in the Bible, the order of how God does things is very, very important. And how do we keep track of all of this? I mean, the pages actually aren't like they are in our Bible. What God is doing is not quite as simple as that. So we have to have something that holds these ideas together that God is going to do, and that is the contracts. The contract holds the entire idea what God is going to do together. And we go into the scriptures with that idea and with that structure, with that framework, and then we start understanding what the Bible is actually doing and what it's actually saying. So the binding of this Bible holds together the place and the order of each page, just as the contracts do of God hold together every statement in the Bible. Now, to destroy Bible truth, just got to destroy the contracts. And that's where we are in our watershed issues. I think I go to somebody and say, I quote to them a Bible verse, like let's just use Genesis 12, 1 through 3. And I quote those verses to the covenantal person, and he says, so what? God changes his mind. Whoa. Contract is unconditional. Well, that's really not true. They broke the law, and therefore God gave up on them. So you go down a different road, totally different road. All right, so the contract is what we want to remember. If you don't remember anything else about this morning, so the Bible is a contract. Look at it as a contract. In fact, it is a tremendously good apologetic. You go to your friends and say, you ever thought of the Bible as a contract? No. It's God's word. How can it be a contract? Well, God tells us what he's going to do. And you get into your little story of what God is doing and why he needed to do the contract to begin with, because what happened in the first 11 chapters of Genesis. So it becomes a great apologetic for witnessing. sake. You know, God is a God of contract. He's a man of his word. What he says he will do, what he said he will mean, and this all this stuff we'll get into later, because another level of attack on the word is on the level of language. The words, it very much attacked today. You know, those are the words, but that's really not what's meant. So we have all these kind of attacks, not only at the contract level, but also in the level of just words. So I have those verses of the contract here. I'm going to leave those for next time.